Hello, and welcome to Making Creativity Pay, the podcast where we talk to people in creative industries about how they promote and market their work. I'm Dan Barnett, and on this episode I spoke with journalist Rachel Healy. Rachel is an award-winning journalist and the current British Journalism Awards Journalist of the Year for Arts and Entertainment. Rachel is a freelance journalist working predominantly with The Guardian and the I newspapers. I talked to Rachel about getting articles commissioned, from show reviews through to in-depth investigative reporting. We also discussed the star rating system of reviews, building a personal brand, as well as a repeated focus in her writing on the financial impact of being an artist, including the experience of performers at the Fringe, which is a perfect fit for this podcast. I started the interview by asking Rachel to give a brief introduction about herself and her work.
I'm Rachel Healy. I'm a journalist. I work a lot as a freelancer, mostly for The Guardian and the I paper, and write about culture, mostly comedy, but also things like theatre and TV. And I also work part-time at a nursing magazine.
And so within that, within journalism, A, did you always want to kind of work in journalism? And B, did culture, was that a particular area that you wanted to do or just something that, you know, through chance you kind of ended up in?
I think, yeah, I did always want to do something that was journalism related or related to writing. And even actually when I was in school, a bunch of us set up a silly little magazine when we were in sixth form. And then I continued to do student media at university. I think it was only when I was getting to my third year that it occurred to me that, oh, actually, this could be a job. And so then I've been sort of trying my best to be a real journalist ever since. And in terms of the culture stuff, I think, yeah, I had always wanted to write about that. I ended up going into other kind of areas and jobs just for sort of financial necessity. But when I started freelancing more and started putting more effort into that, I think at the time I was just seeing a lot of comedy and felt like that was a niche that I had a lot of knowledge about already, and maybe that there was a gap. I wasn't seeing lots of coverage about some of the stuff I found interesting about it. So I just started pitching ideas and it sort of snowballed from there.
Probably how I first came across your stuff, and I think a lot of the stuff you've done is with The Guardian. I mean, how does that kind of relationship work in that, you know, you kind of do a lot of work for them, but you're freelance? How much of it is you've got an idea and you have to pitch the idea, or you've got an article that you then say, you know, is this of interest, or do they come to you, or is it a mix of things?
At this point, it's a mix of things. It definitely started out with me just cold pitching the stage editor there because I thought he would be the best person for the kind of ideas I had at the time. And then it's broadened out to me working with a few different editors. So I'll pitch ideas to the culture editor and stage editor, the Saturday magazine editors, features editors, depending on what the idea is. But I think because I've now been doing it for a few years and sort of working with the paper for a few years, I do also get approached to do certain things. So someone might ask me to do a profile of a particular person or a review or a more complex feature that they just think would fit with the style of stuff that I usually do.
Because, yeah, I thought it'd be useful to kind of talk about some of the pieces I've seen you've done recently and kind of how they came about. I mean, most recently, I think it was just a few days ago, or this time last week, was the piece about Best in Class and the whole kind of thing of, you know, woke ruining comedy and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you get into that?
Well, so for that one, I was talking to Sean Davis, who runs Best in Class and was running this workshop. And there'd obviously been this Telegraph piece that you mentioned, which was saying that there was a woke agenda and that inviting underrepresented people into these comedy grants was kind of ruining comedy. And that piece had come out before she'd actually run the workshop she was doing with the BBC grant money. So she invited me along to attend the workshop. And yeah, so I went along on the day, you know, spoke to a few people who were there, spoke to Sean herself, and actually pitched it just later that day as a wider piece, which was looking at some of the issues for why workshops such as Sean's were needed, but also what some of the other grants had been used for. And I think because it did have that slightly ridiculous newsy angle, thanks to this Telegraph piece, that one got picked up pretty much right away and I just got to work on it.
I know it's something you've written about quite a bit in the past at various fringes about the whole kind of financial aspect, and yeah, it's something that fits perfectly with the ethos of the podcast, is that, you know, it's not about big money, it's about just literally being able to pay and get enough out of your creative work to, you know, for the Fringe, you know, you don't lose so much money that you can't do it the next year, or you
you haven't then got time to do various other creative things, you know, and that just kind of, you know, just totally wipes you out. You want to be able to do well enough to kind of keep going and develop.
Yeah.
I mean, have you found that that's got a lot worse in the last few years, or has it kind of always been, or for the last 10 plus years, has it been bad?
I do think it feels particularly bleak at the moment in a number of different industries. So I'm actually writing the piece that's about sort of gender inequalities in the TV industry at the moment, but it's been kind of inescapable that it's tied to the just general slowdown of work across the industry as well. So there was, you know, some really shocking stats from Bechtu a few weeks ago, which were saying that 68% of freelance workers are currently out of work, something like that. And I think we're seeing sort of similar stuff across film and publishing and journalism and comedy, where it just feels like people do have to almost have a second career to support themselves. And it's not clear where the kind of goals or the safe spot is anymore, where you can just fully concentrate on that thing. So there was another piece I did last year, actually, which there'd been a news story about a band, I think they were from Germany, and they'd been stopped coming into the UK, I guess through new Brexit rules, but they'd been stopped coming in because they all had second jobs. So they weren't classed as proper full-time musicians by the government and therefore couldn't get visas to tour with their band. So off the back of that, I did a feature which was about people in all different areas of the arts who do have second jobs. So I spoke to like Sakisa Bostwick-Barnes, who's a comedian, but she's also an amazing immigration lawyer as well. And then had like a musician and an author. And really, I think I could have gone to any creative sector and you would have found so many people who are incredibly successful in their fields, but they do have a full-time or almost a full-time job just to allow them to do that.
From your point of view, do you still kind of see the Edinburgh Fringe as, whether it's the pinnacle or the be-all and end-all, I mean, does it still have that big kind of peak for people, for performers?
I think it does in a way. I mean, maybe its hold has lessened a bit since the pandemic, just because probably through financial necessity, some people just can't make it work. And, you know, more people, like on your previous episode, when you were speaking to Liam Withnail, he was talking about people going down to like a 2-year cycle instead of doing it every year. And I do think that's more common, or people doing shorter runs as well. But I think just because it's so well established and you do have this wider ecosystem built up where a lot of press are going, a lot of industry people are going, it's overlapping with the TV festival. There's something about this concentration of all those people in the same place, dedicating their entire time to seeing shows and trying to spot talent and whatever else it might be. I think there's something that still feels like it could bear fruit for a lot of people, or purely the opportunity to perform every day will improve them in ways that they wouldn't get a chance to otherwise. But I do think there's a sort of simultaneous recognition that it's not the only way to get seen or the only way to develop as an artist, and that actually, because it's becoming less and less accessible, there have to be other ways and we have to cultivate other ways to make it fairer.
Yes, I was going to say, is that obviously Edinburgh is super important in August. But anything that's not London tends to be, I mean, you know, you know a lot better than me, whether it's kind of forgotten about the rest of the year. So, you know, if there's a particular artist in Manchester or Bristol, do they get as much attention as maybe they should? Or do they have to come to London for that attention?
Yeah, I think that's a tough question. And like, I try and keep an eye on stuff that's happening in, you know, Scotland, Wales, Newcastle, Manchester, Bristol, wherever it may be. But it obviously, like, I'm restricted by the cost of traveling. Publications aren't always willing to, you know, put up that cost to let people travel. I mean, it started just before the pandemic began. I had a series with The Guardian where I was looking at the comedy scenes in different cities around the UK, and I managed to travel to 2 before the pandemic began, and then I had 2 people remotely. But I think more of that kind of stuff would help, where, you know, in that case, The Guardian was willing to put up the cost of allowing me to travel and to like go and explore and meet people. But then I guess that there are also great journalists in so many of these places who do have their eye on the ball. Like the Scottish scene has great coverage because they've got a great kind of network of arts and culture journalists there who, yeah, they cover the fringe and the festivals, but they are there year round and they know what's great. Yeah, I think it probably is more difficult, but it's become less difficult with social media and the internet to just get on the radar of people and to share bits of your work. And then if you are at a festival or wherever different journalists tend to be, then hopefully they will put in the effort to go and see you do a full show.
And in terms of reviews, I mean, it's one of the things I wanted to talk about. So I spoke to the Fergus Morgan, who writes for The Stage and The Scotsman, about, you know, kind of he kind of, putting words in his mouth, kind of hates kind of that, the kind of star system that, you know, you could write 500, 1,000 words on something, but someone will go, well, it's 2 stars, 3 stars, you know, that's good, that's not very good, and so on. Yes, I mean, there was a review you did recently with Celia AB, where it was a 2-star review. And so, you know, if you just saw that, you think, well, that's disappointing. But, you know, you read the whole piece and you kind of see, well, you know, there's lots of positives in there. But I mean, how do you kind of balance that when, you know, I'm sure you'll get various comments on, well, why is it only a 2 or why is it not more and so on?
Yeah, it is difficult. I think, you know, it doesn't feel good to, especially when you really like and admire that artist, like with Celia. And I do spend a lot of time contemplating what it should be and why. And I think, you know, as you said, you have to justify and explain that in the review itself. And hopefully that particular review did do that. But yeah, I share that fear that a lot of people don't give the time to read the whole review, even though they're often quite short. But I think, yeah, ultimately you have to be considered and you have to be honest. I do think that, you know, timeout system is quite interesting, where they now, I think, only show the stars for things that get 3 and upward, and they just don't show the stars. They just present the written review for other shows. So I think maybe you would then go into reading that review with less of a negative mindset, perhaps, and maybe that feels better for artists. I'm not sure. But yeah, I do always think it through and even second guess and have self-doubt about what to give it in terms of a star rating. And you find yourself trying to triangulate between all the shows you've seen and all the reviews you've done in the past. Like, I recently reviewed Julia Masley and then saw the show again later in the week and sort of regretted that I hadn't given it an extra star. But I don't know, I think you can overthink, but it's good to be, you know, not just flying off with first instinct, but really considering it.
Not wanting to question your journalistic ethics, but it's obviously difficult as well as a freelancer when you're looking to speak to these people and get interviews with them and everything else. I'm not saying, you know, you bump everyone up to an extra star, but that must be a difficult dynamic as well. Or you just hoping that, you know, even if the review isn't good, some, you know, an artist will read the review and kind of, even if they don't agree with it, can kind of see where you're coming from.
Yeah, I think that probably is a danger, that someone might be put off being interviewed by you in the future based on that. And I don't think that's happened yet, but it is a possibility. Yeah, I think I do know that some people kind of, I guess, like ethically, morally, feel that you shouldn't do a review and do a profile of someone, at least not within like a year or a shortish time period, because there's a bit of a conflict there anyway, either, you know, whichever order they come in. But yeah, I think it's probably something that maybe you have to consider. But then again, it does come down to being honest and just hoping that people take that for what it is.
Talking to Fergus, who's obviously based up in Scotland previously, where, you know, he's kind of said it's a huge part of his yearly plan is the fringe. It's not like there's complete absence of culture the rest of the year, but, you know, it is the big thing and it generates a lot more interest. And, you know, and as a freelancer, that's a big thing for him. I mean, is it similar for you?
I think it is quite a big part of the year, in that already kind of later this month and in April, I'll probably start, and, you know, having meetings with people about who's going up and what they're going to be doing there. And I think for me, it's just a brilliant opportunity to see as many shows as possible, which will then probably be touring kind of in the autumn and in the start of the next year, and will give me material to kind of like pin pictures to whether that be like trend pieces or profiles or whatever. So it's a good kind of source material. I think in terms of like the year's income, maybe less so, although it is such a concentrated period of work that, like, especially last year, I think I did, you know, such a mix of profiles and features and reviews and previews that it did turn out to be a significant chunk of like the summer's work.
And so as a freelancer, I mean, will The Guardian kind of almost have you exclusively for August, or is it just, you know, anyone will have you kind of thing?
So last year was a bit different because I was on the Edinburgh Comedy Award panel. So I was being housed by the awards for the month, and it meant that I had kind of more time there. I did do the bulk of the work when I was there for The Guardian, but I did a few things for the iPaper as well. Kind of some before, some reviews during, and then like a couple of profiles after. So it was a mix, but I think, you know, The Guardian and other papers do have maybe some accommodation that they'll kind of like tag team their writers into. So you'd more likely just be there for sort of 6 days or so and concentrate that time on just working for them. So it might be a bit different this year. We'll see.
So in your head, it may be that, you know, a bit like some of the performers, you know, they can't afford to go up there for a month. It might be a case that, you know, you go up for a week and you just try and cram everything into that week, is it?
Yeah, that's it. That's how it had been the previous couple of years, just going up for a shorter period of time and just, yeah, cramming in as much as you can for that time, which is a lot, but it doesn't feel like much compared to the scale of the festival itself.
And I know lots of people complain or are a bit annoyed that, you know, reviews will tend to center around certain areas, probably both physical and in terms of location. You know, if you're slightly further out of the center, then forget it. Because, I mean, obviously, if you've got thousands of things literally on your doorstep, you're not going to, you know, even if it's only 20 minutes away, you know, further out of town, you know, why would you? And, you know, that must be difficult. I mean, do you try and see different things and almost force yourself to kind of look for something different?
Yeah, definitely. I saw some people last year who were saying that shows that had been at the stand had particularly suffered. I don't know what it was about last year, but I think that generally Newtown has like a little bit less foot traffic than Old Town. But yeah, I just try and put together a sort of mega list of things that I'd be interested in, you know, way before the festival starts. And that will include more established people or people that I've seen do bits here and there, as well as completely new people and people from all around the country and, you know, overseas as well. And try not to let where the actual show itself is dictate who I most want to see off that list. Obviously, in terms of the assignments you get, there will be certain things that you just have to see. But in terms of fitting other things in, I just try and be driven by who I think is artistically interesting or shows that kind of grip me in some way.
And so for something like Glasgow Comedy Festival that's coming up, is that just because it's too far away? You know, even though it's 3 weeks of, you know, quite concentrated comedy, it's just, you know, too physically far away for you to kind of get too involved in?
Yeah, I think it is. It's quite a tough one because I guess it's sort of an opportunity for writers who are living there or who are close by to kind of give that coverage. But it's, you know, I do keep an eye on all of the other festivals like Leicester and Glasgow and Aberystwyth and McCunliffe and, you know, whatever else is going on. But I just might not always be able to get there myself. And it would be great, you know, I'd love to just go and watch comedy for a few weekends or whatever, but a lot of them do tend to be more kind of weekend based rather than that concentration that you get in Edinburgh. And obviously when you're doing other work as well, it's quite tough to just take yourself off for a week or two and be, you know, paying to stay there and all the other things that come with it.
And so as well as kind of reviews and artist profiles, you do more investigative journalism and things like that. How does that work as a freelance? Because, you know, it's kind of interesting, you know, that's the kind of thing that could take weeks of your time for,
yes.
And it might take weeks of time for a story that never actually happens for one reason or another. It doesn't come out. I mean, that must be, it's probably very fulfilling, but not for financially. It's obviously quite risky and quite onerous.
Yeah, for sure. And when I was, I guess, first starting out with this, I really wasn't sure the best way to go about it. And I had a really useful conversation with another freelancer called Lucy Osborne, who's done just loads of incredible work into like the modeling industry and stories about Donald Trump, really great investigative stuff. And she gave me some good advice on, as a freelancer, how the different ways that you could work with a publication and what might be the best way, depending on the sort of story you're looking into. But I think ultimately you need to be in a working arrangement where you're being paid a day rate as opposed to, you know, a line rate or per word rate that you'd get on a usual commissions, because it really is about the time you're putting into it rather than the length of the final product. So that's the way that I've been working on stuff in recent years, and I think that definitely works.
Recent episode we had with Zoe Paskett, who's runs, I'll try and get it right, LMAONAs, get it right first time, an online newsletter, and she's crowdfunding a print newspaper, which is really interesting. I mean, you kind of see both the website and the print side, obviously working with The Guardian. Do you think that there's room for print and the whole kind of area of kind of curation?
Yeah, I think there's like definitely a market for quality independent content in particular. Like, obviously, it's not been an amazing few years in journalism, with a lot of publications kind of having mass layoffs or closing down, like the recent Vice News. But in other ways, we've seen some really interesting things springing up, like, you know, with the kind of slow death of certain areas of local journalism. For example, we've now seen things like the Manchester Mill and like the Ferret in Scotland kind of coming up in their place, these like really small independent ventures that people are paying for and are doing good in-depth work, coming in to kind of fill that void. And I think that we're kind of going to see that in other areas beyond local journalism as well. And Zoe's project is a great example of that. I guess some of them have done really well across, like cross platforms, like print, online, podcasts, thinking of stuff like Polyester and maybe Hook magazine, stuff like that. But I think with print, it's nice that it kind of ties the cost of labor to the cost of the product itself, which often feels completely lost online. I think there is something really nice about having a product that you can hold in your hand and kind of take time over. And stuff like the success of the London Review of Books, I think, shows that that is something that certain people do want. It's tricky though, because as I said, I work on a nursing magazine as well, and that's with the Royal College of Nursing. And only a year or so ago, we actually scrapped the print issues of that magazine because general feedback showed that not everyone was kind of consuming it in physical form, and a lot of people felt it was environmentally unfriendly, and you know, the costs are just always going up. Not everyone felt it was a good use of money. But yeah, I think that quality independent content is kind of wanted and needed, and it's really good and nice to see that in print sometimes.
And so one of the other things I wanted to ask is, as a journalist, as a freelancer, how much, for want of a better phrase, do you think about your own brand and, you know, getting your name out there and being associated with good journalism, good stories, and all the rest of it? I mean, do you feel that you're experienced enough now that kind of your work speaks for itself, you don't have to worry too much about that? Or do you still have to kind of say, you know, hi, it's me, I'm here, I'm great, kind of thing, you know, kind of get yourself noticed?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like the self-promotion thing doesn't always come super naturally to me. And it's, I think I just realized that you just have to do it. Otherwise, who knows that you exist and what you're doing? And I, you know, I feel very comfortable sort of sharing the work I'm doing, and probably less so with that combination of kind of personal and professional that some people seem to do really well and comes easily to them. But that doesn't come easily to me, I don't think. But I hope that my work kind of feels coherent at this point, and that someone could see it and think, oh yeah, I'd like Rachel to do this or to do that. I think, yeah, I don't know, it's tricky. I always sort of debate, because I do have this other job which takes up half my week, and sometimes debate, oh, what more could I do if I didn't have that job? But then at the same time, I think the security of that has allowed me to focus my freelance time on things that make sense to me and that I really do want to explore, which perhaps has allowed me to cultivate a sort of more coherent body of work, maybe.
And I mean, on that, I mean, don't think you do. Correct me if I'm wrong. You don't have like a personal newsletter or anything like that at the moment that you do?
No, not yet. No, I've just got still using Twitter or X or whatever calling it, and also Instagram for work purposes, but only for the past kind of year and a half, 2 years on there. I haven't branched out into Substack or podcasts, TikTok yet, but I suppose those are all areas that are open for exploration. I think it's tricky though, because just like the danger of having any sort of online profile or posting anything is that people are always probably going to fill in the gaps for themselves and make assumptions about who you are and what you do and what you think. So I think it's almost too anxiety inducing to think it through too much. And actually, you've just got to consider what you are most comfortable with. And yeah, there's probably an element of deciding how you want to be perceived by your industry or your peers, but it has to be in a way that you feel like you're comfortable and it is reflecting yourself. I think probably be too stressful to create a persona all the time to me anyway.
So if somebody thought I'd love an article in The Guardian, or I'd love you to review me and other kind of things, I mean, what's the best kind of way to kind of catch your eye, to get you interested?
I absolutely invite people to just message me, either sending an email or even, you know, DMing me on like Instagram, for example, just to sort of make me aware of their work and who they are and what they're doing. I'll try and go to shows that I think are interesting if people invite me, because I do want to see new people live all the time. It's difficult because although I invite that, it doesn't mean that I'll necessarily be able to review someone or cover them in some way, but sometimes it can lead to some kind of long-term benefit where, you know, I might not be able to write something right now, but at least you're now on my radar and I'll be able to consider you when I'm coming up with ideas or when I'm writing about a certain topic in the future. Yeah, it's tricky. I feel like, especially with reviews, people often understandably are so desperate for those just to get their work out there. And it just feels like there's so little space in publications at the moment for those reviews. And, you know, physical space has been cut in print, budgets have been cut, and there are just fewer opportunities to review things, especially new kind of emerging artists. So I'd say always get in touch, always invite me to stuff and share things with me, send me clips of stuff you've done. And, you know, let's start like a long-term, let's get to know each other sort of thing, but it might not be an immediate, I'm going to write about it now.
And in terms of kind of where you find new things, is that generally social media, or there's particular venues that you think, well, they always curate good people. So, you know, whether it's the Pleasance or wherever it may be, you kind of think, well, if something's on there, it must be of a certain standard and that gets you interested.
Yeah, I'd say there's like a mix of stuff. So I'll try and go and see a lot of kind of mixed bill nights so that I can get a taste of lots of different people just doing 10, 15 minutes or whatever it is. I'll try and see things out because I'm in London, so I'll try and see things at like the Bill Murray and Soho Theatre and Museum of Comedy and wherever else as much as possible. But I will just keep an eye on people I'm interested in on social media as well and see where they're gigging. When I'm in the Northeast, I'll try and see stuff like in Newcastle as well, and, you know, do try and go to other festivals and events in different parts of the country when I can. So I think it's just about keeping an eye across all those different things, rather than just like restricting yourself to one venue or people you already know on social media. I'm definitely always open to exploring what new people are doing.
Thanks to Rachel, and thanks for listening. There's more details in the show notes about where you can find Rachel and her work online. If you enjoyed this, check out some of our previous episodes where we speak to people about making creativity pay.